This is Seattle, Washington, February 27, 1980. Side one, the second part of two tapes, a discussion between Professor Martin Duffy and Christine Miller, labor research analyst, Department of Labor Education for the University of Minnesota, and myself concerning the Minneapolis General Driver Strikes of 1934. This interview or discussion will be held on March 5, 1980, instead of the previous date.
I'm ready when you are.
All right. We're all set.
Now, I talked about what I consider to be an unsavory role. The way I read about it was that there was almost a physical confrontation at the brewery, and the drivers were transferred into the drivers' union, and I think they eventually wound up making a union. They included them in a union. Now, I don't know if you are familiar, and this is part of, again, now we're talking history here. It's well to give my version of what I think the Teamsters Union was. It may rub off on you for understanding.
Okay.
The basic role of 574, as envisioned by Ray Dunn, by Carl Skogman in the first instance, and Dobbs a few months later, was to create an industrial union. That is the theory that I subscribed to when I saw that this was the way to go. And it was Carl Skogman who convinced me. Not Ray, not Farrell. They both would have sold the same thing, but I had my discussions with Carl. And he pointed out that the role that the Teamsters Union had for fragmentizing the industry was one that worked against the best industry of all the drivers. Carl took the position that all workers are basic workers, and there are categories of work. And the more you separate the categories of work, the more you differentiate, you don't have a common policy, you have a whole myriad of aims, objectives, and understandings, and it weakens rather than strengthens the union. Now, our concept in Minneapolis was to get all the drivers into one union, and so far as possible, it could be handled in one union. Now, the role that the Teamsters Union had been following prior to that time was that they would differentiate all the various drivers, and for the most part prior to 1933, my knowledge and my reading and my day-to-day experience in it supports the fact that the Teamsters Union had an overwhelming majority of its members in what was called the commission driver salesman area. The linen laundry drivers, the tea and coffee wagon drivers. As a matter of fact, in the early 30s, the president of the powerful Teamsters Joint Council was Les Gowdy. And Les Gowdy was come from the tea and coffee wagon drivers union.
Mm-hmm.
They organized these things, and as I told you earlier, they were more or less trade collaboration agreements with the employers. In other words, the drivers would be on the street during certain hours. There wouldn't be any unfair competition by somebody moonlighting out at 2 in the morning and staying till midnight. That they had starting times and closing times. And if you dig into the old contracts in the Teamsters Union, you'll find in the milk wagon drivers, in the bakery drivers, in the tea and coffee wagon, in the laundry drivers. They all had these rules, and no driver shall be out before X hour, and no driver shall be on the street after X hour. Well, Carl spoke against that. He said, if we are going to organize this city, we have to embrace all the workers. And that's what the big fight was over on the inside worker. And that was the crucial fight with the employers in Minneapolis. They understood. The theory of the Teamsters Union, the great amalgamation of people brought together now, would not have been done had Tobin's premise and thoughts and understanding prevail. Now, I'm not going to be so naive as to say that we done it. But we certainly established the criteria that inside workers, platform workers, warehouse workers, and all people that were connected in the industry should be represented in the same union. And never mind the drivers. We would have never had the strikes in Minneapolis that we had if it wouldn't have been for that principle.
Well, I think that the information you're presenting to us now is confirmed by the fact that the employers fought so hard to defeat you, because they understood that this was going to bring a whole new wave and type of organization to the city of Minneapolis.
But they're not only there, but to the nation.
Of course not. They were most concerned with Minneapolis.
No.
Employers, but
no, the union
accounts for the vigilance of their opposition to you.
Yes. Now, the original aim of the union, they've gone far beyond that in the Teamsters today, and I don't see any fault in it. They've organized those people who are not organized. They have also organized some people that were previously organized, to wit, the Minneapolis Honeywell Heat Regulator, for one, and other industries which have been previously in another union. Now, we're not going to get into the merits of pros and cons of A and B and C, but the fact is that the overwhelming majority of the Teamsters Union today, I would bet my house on it, are non-drivers. They're not members. They're not what you call truck drivers. They're not Teamsters, stablemen, or warehousemen.
Well, that's growing ever more true also.
And there's nothing wrong with it. I don't see... my brother belongs to a union, 320, when I come to think of it now. They have the law enforcement officers in that union.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the Teamsters are really organizing a lot of women now.
Well, that's true.
Clerical positions.
And there's nothing wrong in that. Only thing is that they're 40 years too late.
Well, I don't think they're headed for the one big union yet.
No, no.
But I don't think that's what's motivating them.
No.
But it makes sense to be organizing people now.
That's right. And
the Teamsters are doing it very successfully.
They have, over the years, been more successful in organizing people than all of the other unions. Now, there are some tremendous areas yet to be organized. And there are some of the big unions that are tangling with this proposition. And one is the United Mine Workers, the organizing of the Western coal operators. Pardon me, where we have the strip mines, where we have the open pit mining like they're doing out in the West. And that is becoming a big thing there. And in some instances, the Teamsters are involved in organizing certain of the mines. I don't have any quarrel where the people are organized, because we took the position and we developed the theory that everybody working in the industry in the given area that's subject to the trades and the prices and everything in that area should be on a competitive wage base. And we took a strong position against sweetheart agreements. And we fought in Minneapolis. Why, you can read the Minneapolis papers of 1934, you're privy to them there, about the fight about the inside workers and the chicken pickers. And we knew, and there were girls on the belts in the Dayton Company. Let's see, over Donaldson's, I don't think they had them. I think they were girls on the belt at Powers. Our leader didn't have that. Rector's
on the belt, what do you mean?
Well, when you go into a department store and you purchase a package, it's wrapped. Then it's taken either by a chute or by a cart down to the delivery room. And all the packages that are going out to eventually be delivered are thrown on that belt. They're put there by the sorter. He sorts them, and or the route man. He marks the route numbers on them. He picks the package up, and if it's going to 50th and Aldrich, he puts a number on it. It's thrown on the belt. Now that package is recorded. It's picked up. This is the old days. I don't know what they're doing. They probably got UPS around there now, and it's all done differently. But in those days, they all had their own delivery departments. And they had this big, long belt. And there were girls standing along this belt. And when, if they had bins 40, 50, and 60 in that bracket, they'd grab all the packages that were to come to that route number. And they would either stub them, that is, tear off the stub on the sales slip, or book them on a sheet. And there were mostly girls that done that. We didn't have them in the union in 34. We had some women. The Morrisell Rothschild, the Palace Clothing House, used to be on 4th and Nicollet. We had some women in the delivery room there.
Who were members of the Teamsters?
Yeah, just a couple, though. There were not too many, because this was non-traditional. But on the belts in the delivery room, and all the comeback desks, that is, when you'd go out and you'd bring merchandise that you picked up or you couldn't deliver, we call it the comebacks. Merchandise that come back into the store had to be signed off of your sheet or credit given that you returned it, or pickups that you'd made. This was all done by women. They were right in the delivery rooms at the Dayton Company and Powers for two. I think over Donaldson's, we had a barn over there on 13th Street, 13th Avenue South and 8th Street at the time. And I think there were men over there. There were men there that were young men on the belt. And there were some women around in the offices and in certain of the jobs. But we were fighting for the right to have women represented in the industry and to be a part of it. And we were far ahead of our time, you'll have to admit. And now the Teamsters are going, and I find no fault in that. As a matter of fact, there are many unions. One of the biggest unions in the Long Beach area, the recording secretary, is a woman. LaVon McGinty, I think, is her name. I get papers from there. That's why I happen to know about it. And there's many of them where the women are recording secretaries, and in some instances, business agents. They haven't yet got business agents in the heavy freight field, but there are women, I think, in the Teamsters Joint Council here. I think they have one woman business agent here.
Well, we've got a local president, female local president here, Sylvia Dombrowski.
And what?
Sylvia Dombrowski is the president of the Teamsters local here.
And what is that?
Clerks? A flight attendant.
What? No, oh, flight attendants. Oh, yes, yes, sure. They've got lots of them.
I wanted to ask you if you see any connection between the fact that Local 574 opened up the city of Minneapolis in terms of organizing on more of an industrial basis as opposed to trade basis. If there's any connection between that fact and the fact that the Teamsters today are branching out in their organizing efforts. Do you think what happened in 1934 is in some way a cause of what's happening today with the Teamsters and their organizing efforts?
Well, I tell you, I believe there is some, and maybe it's not, how am I going to say, maybe it's not a designed thought, but I believe that we could safely say that history repeats itself, and many of the people that have observed what's been done in the Teamsters Union and looking over the record and say, by God, it worked then, why won't it work now? I think there might be some connection. The history of the growth of the Teamsters Union, the greatest period of growth development, per capita-wise, was in that period when we were organizing and setting up the over-the-road with the council form of organization in the Teamsters Union.
Well, people are voting for the Teamsters Union not simply because they need a union. They're voting for the Teamsters for a particular reason, whereas they might not vote for another union in the union election. So there seems to be a preference for the Teamsters Union.
Yes.
When there's a choice.
In many instances, yes. And I would suppose that the people that are voting, for the most part, now we're not talking about unions that have been primarily organized, we're talking about in new fields.
Yes, yes.
And these people probably feel that the Teamsters Union has got more support and more strength to offer them than some of the competing unions that are in the field with them. It isn't because I don't believe that people are knowledgeable about the Teamster history and that they don't know all the pitfalls or all the good points of the Teamsters Union, you know, in particular. But I couldn't dispute the fact that the records show that the Teamsters win a majority of elections that they participate in. And for the most part, the people feel that the Teamsters will be able to do better for them than some of the Casper Milquetoast unions that they're in the field.
Well, I think that one of the images that the Teamsters Union has carried around for many years is that they are a corrupt union.
Right.
And I think that more and more people are beginning to believe that it has been or is individuals within the Teamsters Union that caused that image to prevail.
That's right.
But that in fact the Teamsters Union is simply a powerful union, and that is the issue. I think that's why people vote for the Teamsters. That will be the union that can get something for them. That's what I've heard people say.
You know, basically, there's another area that we should touch on that we're talking about in generality here. We have the question of today, what motivates most people. Now, all the people that I've known and represented, they're not only concerned about what happens to them on the job, they're concerned about their everyday life off the job. Health and welfare, pensions, and so forth. Now, for all the garbage they want to throw at the Teamsters Pension Fund, it's not all as bad as they would make it out. The Teamsters Pension Fund has been the target of the big banking industry. So there's been a lot of unfavorable publicity given to the Teamsters Pension Fund, which in many instances is more sound than most of the business in the same field. Now, on the question of medical benefits and so forth, in most instances, the Teamsters have a little better show than the other unions. And these kind of things, plus the fact that the Teamsters do go out and strike employers and win contracts, is a thing that I suppose has some influence with the people that join the Teamsters or vote for the Teamsters. The Teamsters Union image, while it's been made by the press to be pretty sordid, and we have to admit that in certain instances some of the people that are in the positions of power in the Teamsters Union are a lot to be desired when it comes from my standard of a trade union official. The vast majority of the Teamsters Union is made up of working stiffs that don't have any cotton to be in that area at all. But certain enterprising people have taken advantage of the goodwill of people and put themselves in a position which is attacked by the media to give the whole union a bad name. And I just can't write the Teamsters Union off like that, nor any other union. But it's natural that you get a controversial figure like Tony Prohl, or you get some instances like young Fitzsimmons getting caught with his hand in the cookie jar, which is one of the reasons why Teamsters don't report bad equipment, because if you get known as a gripester, you know, you go down the road. So, instances like that, but you don't hear of all the good that the Teamsters Union does, and they do some good. They certainly do a lot of good. I'm not going to get up and say that the Teamsters Union is loaded down with a bunch of corrupt people. I do say they've got more than their share of fat bureaucrats around. And the reason is they're a bigger union. There's many other unions that got fat bureaucrats too, you know. But the whole concept is that the Teamsters are out on an aggressive thing. And another thing, if they lose in a plant, they don't fold up and run and say, well, Jesus, we've lost the world. They'll start out in another plant. And there is, of course, areas where the Teamsters Union have given up the fight. There's areas where they have neglected a tremendous source that someday is going to wind up to bite them in the proverbial butt. And that's the owner-operator. They're just closing their eyes to the owner-operator. And as more and more leasing agencies come in, the actual drivers will be represented by other groups in these individual owner associations.
Well, do you think that that is well recognized by the union leadership, and that is one of the reasons that there is this branching out of organization of other types of workers?
Well, I can't answer that in a specific or categorical way, but I'd have to say that maybe they are better able, they feel, to get in and do something in the other fields where they can't do much in the owner-operator field.
Well, I suppose my question was kind of silly, because there really isn't any... It would be silly to think that there is one reason why...
No, I think...
single reason why...
No, I accepted your question the way it was posed, was that there are people who want to be organized, and they, for the most part, here, I feel, if I can soapbox, I feel that part of this vast area of, I don't know if it's indifference, because the Teamsters are not indifferent to it, but neglect, let me say that, is brought about because, for the most part, the Teamsters Union are very much involved in deep democratic politics. Practically every local union paper that I pick up, and I get many of them, carry the same line. There's more emphasis to the Democratic Party than there is to the trade union. The newspapers are a combination Democratic Party sheet and an obituary column. And there is very little evidence of union interworking problems. The International Union Magazine is a disgrace, in my opinion. The best two papers that I have seen, I think the outstanding paper is the one written by Gus Lump in St. Louis, the Missouri Teamster. The second best paper that I've read is the Washington Teamster. And it's a short little tabloid, not nearly as big as the Teamster paper in Missouri. But the editor is a very able guy. And so is Gus Lump. And they're capable of doing a much better job than they do. But the Missouri Teamster paper gets into areas, you know, they get into race areas and women areas and things like that, which most of the Teamster papers disregard.
still it, they address issues that are of greater concern to the people reading.
Yes, they do. And maybe part of that might be because of Hal Gibbons in his early days that instilled that thing. Or maybe it's because of the power of the union, or maybe it's because of the... I don't know any of the officials anymore around St. Louis. But they've been involved in some big, big things there. And, of course, the Teamsters Union... I see nothing with the union getting involved in politics, but where they're being betrayed at every turn of the road by politicians. Here we've got Kennedy out for wage and price controls, and he's for deregulation of the industry. You know, of course, from one standpoint, the unions have been practically subjected to wage controls for years and years and years. And this hoax that Carter's pulling off, he ain't for wage and price controls. Interest going to 17.75% and wages to be held down between 7 and 9. I don't know what you call that. So I was talking to a guy, a former business agent, he's retired now, of the Boilermakers Union yesterday. And he was telling me, well, he said, Kennedy ain't so far wrong. He says the union is subjected to wage controls for years. And Carter particularly coming out, lashing out at the unions for 7%. And then we're talking about that demagogic individual in Chicago, that Mayor Byrne. That's terrible what she's doing. And, of course, you get wrapped up in those kind of politics. I think part of the reason that they're having this problem with the individual owner is that it's a bigger problem. When I date this back to part of it to Fitzsimmons, allowing the union to come back to the baronial controls, where the union, the Teamsters Union was on the march in the late 30s and early 40s to becoming an international union. And when Fitzsimmons got a hold of the thing, why, he allowed the baronial empires to raise their heads again. And they're around, believe me. When I hear the drivers on the street talk about the big man, they got to go and see the big man, and they're talking about the head of the joint council, and I shake my head on that. And the ritual that they are going through. And I think part of their reason is that they're not doing like they're doing down in California, trying to form, and boy, the Teamsters could be so powerful if they'd ever get on the march, to set up an antidote to this political mess we're in between the Democrats and the Republicans. Now, the head of the laborers' union, I believe it was down there, said, well, you want a third party? Oh, he said, I'm not concerned about third party. I view it as a two-party system. He says, we'd have a third party, which Henning is trying to get here, a labor party, which would be, in your version, a third party. But he said, in my opinion, it would be a labor party. And the other party, which is the Democrats and Republicans, he says, basically, there's no difference. And I, you know, there's a lot of reason there. Mm-hmm. And I think that the Teamsters, if they ever got going and started to use their political clout and lined it up right, they could be one hell of an influence in this country.
Well, it may be with the changing character of its membership that kind of change may be forced on them.
Yes.
That kind of development of a different political...
Oh, I agree. I don't know if you... I don't know if you are saying that. I don't suppose you probably are, but I believe that the change in the Teamsters Union is going to be one that's brought about by compulsion rather than by design. I think they will be compelled to recognize.
That is what I'm saying.
Uh-huh. Well, that's what I believe. And what's uppermost in my mind is the success the dissident groups are getting.
Well, I think that to a certain extent, bridges are being burned behind the leadership, the incumbents.
Right.
With the entry of different types of workers into the Teamsters organization, and combined with the victories of the dissident groups within the union, I think that the Teamsters Union is probably getting to the point of no return in terms of addressing serious issues of concern to the membership.
True.
They can no longer ignore certain things.
I would subscribe to that. Secondly, we could say, like the old gambler says, time to look at the whole card. Now, there's something else that may have a bearing in this trend. You know, America is becoming a little bit different in the world of international trade and everything. We're not what we were 25 years ago. There's some changes going on. And we're not powerful enough now to do what we want to do. We've got that United Nations. We're paying the rent and the board and the room for all them dudes there. How many of them there that we're not subsidizing and underwriting? We're going to get votes out of them or they don't come back next year. But the real point is that I believe that the power America is having in world markets, we're not no more the leader, if we ever were, the absolute leader, of conditions. I read in the various papers and different things, and occasionally I take a peek in at the Manchester Guardian and the London Times and things like that, and I can read between the lines that many other countries are now far ahead of us in social and health care for the population. Their standard of wages is above ours, and lots of the things that we think we have, they actually do have. And some of the bad things that we still got, they have obliterated. Now, this in turn makes people look a little bit differently. And our balance of trade, the deficits that we have, all of this may unconsciously, it doesn't, I know, affect the guy in the plant, it don't affect the guy on the truck, maybe the average driver, but it's having a reflection otherwise. And I think it's starting to wear off. I think it's starting to wear off. That people are getting the idea that there's got to be some changes made. And whether or not we're going to accept the energy situation as the only thing, that's another very, very deep area to speculate in. Because I don't know how the American worker can continue to maintain the profits of the oil cartel at their tremendous profits as the way it affects our life. Gas out here runs between a dollar and a quarter and $1.35 a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
Heating oil runs from $1.03 to $1.23 a gallon. Now, those things make tremendous differences. Everything you buy in accordance, it's got a petroleum connection. You're not just paying it on gas. You buy a roll of tar paper.
Sure.
Anything that you go to buy.
Yeah, it requires.
And the people, I don't know how much longer they can get a 7% wage increase and inflation at 18%, which is admitted. Why, my goodness, how long can people go before they start rebelling? Now, I don't know what this is going to mean, this 18% interest to the average person. Houses, I suppose, are out of the sight of the average worker. Where's he going to live? I got a nephew that's looking for a house. He's living in an apartment now. They've got a youngster, about 2 years old. They want to get better accommodations. And they're willing to go in the neighborhood of $500 a month. They can't find a house that's suitable at $500 a month.
Oh, God.
Now, that's the conditions here.
Uh-huh.
And he's been looking for 2 months. Find something that he can go in one of the suburbs out here. And then you're faced with that gas problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, will we be able to get it? Let alone, should we have to pay $2 a gallon for it? And you're looking at a car, $7,000, and a home at $90,000, or rents at $500 a month, $400. I tell you, he's very lucky. He's in a place where the guy's a very reasonable guy. There's an 8-unit apartment, and he's paying $230 a month for an apartment. It's nice, but they're outgrowing it.
Yeah.
It's fine for him and her.
Well, it's just, you know, that is happening to so many people that the American dream is just...
Well, it's dissipated.
Yeah, there just is no such thing.
And...
unattainable.
I don't know where, in good conscience, how you can tell people to buy a house for $90,000, the man and wife work, and maybe they can make it. How long can the economy employ both man and woman? Or one or the other? We're not stable whatsoever. And this whole facade about this election is the biggest farce in the world. And we're going to pay for it. And I think that Carter is the biggest bust that ever come across the American political scene. And I see the people enraptured with him. Now, I don't know if you paid any significance to it, but John Anderson is coming from up from no place.
I have been...
I watched him on 60 Minutes the other night.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard him talk. And he's liable to walk away with a lot of votes that they didn't figure he'd get. Now, what's the cause of that?
Well, some people are not as enraptured of Carter as you... as you've indicated, some are.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of people are carried... a lot of people are carried away with the Iranian and Afghanistan situation. And that's given Carter more support than he would normally get. He, in my opinion, is an indecisive, incompetent person. And as long as we're going to have that kind of leadership around, I don't know what we could wind up with.
Well, he's, politically very astute, and he's making the most of an unfortunate situation in order to try to turn people's attention away from the real deficiencies in his quality or lack thereof of leadership.
Yeah, well, I tell you what I'm worried about, that whole apparatus is that Zubrinsky. I call him Ziggy. Boy, I'm worried about him. Yeah, he comes from the Trilateral Commission. That's a product of David Rockefeller. And his whole background is what he's done in Pakistan the other day and what he's running around there assuming the role of leadership. That's scary. Because he's the worst kind of a hawk. The worst kind. And there's a debate going on, if I'm to read what I read in the New York Times, the Washington Post, about two differences of opinion between Vance and Ziggy, and who's who. It's a scary situation, Chris.
Well, it is, because it seems as though, you know, so much is being done under pretense or under guise of achieving something else.
That's right.
Just,
fraud.
Yeah, I guess that's the word for it.
I just call it fraud. American people are not being told the truth. I'm going to send you an article that I copied out of the Minnesota Missouri Teamster, which they lifted from part of the talk of Senator Eagleton.
Oh.
And they just commenting about this farce about the oil industry and what they're doing with it. And we've now developed 11% less gas has been produced by America in 1980 than they did in 1973. And the monies that are supposed to go to buy and use for exploratory and new fields, they're buying up Montgomery Wards and buying up competitors. And the people are blissfully going along, and well, the G-men got them, they must be guilty, huh? Before, you know, they had the FBI, they had the government men, they called them G-men.
Mm-hmm.
And they, it was a joke going around, the G-men got them, they must be guilty. People didn't realize that how close we are to fascism, that once the authorities grab you, you're guilty. That was at that time. That was during the Hitler days. Well, I don't know how much more time we've got. We didn't even get to talk about Fritz Snyder. How much time have we got?
Not too much time. I want to ask you...
Go ahead.
this isn't about the strike either, but that's okay. We've gotten this far. About what happened with the UN the other day and McHenry.
Who?
The UN and McHenry supposedly voted incorrectly on the Israeli settlement question. And the president said that he was given incorrect instructions, and so now Cy Vance is taking it on the chin for an alleged error.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I found that very interesting, that whole scenario that developed around that question of the West Bank settlement.
Mm-hmm.
But that whole maneuver, and I see it as one big manipulation
right.
by the Carter administration, to make it to confuse the public and have the public wondering whether or not it was really a mistake, number one, and if it wasn't, then why have they gone through all the gymnastics since then, and why, you know, I just found that whole thing very perplexing. And
well, I think that it was deliberately contrived.
I do, too.
I can't feel that on such a sensitive thing that the president would issue orders to do one thing and somebody else carry it out the other way. You know what it reminds me of was that fiasco that John Kennedy pulled off on Adlai Stevenson on the Bay of Pigs invasion, where he was telling him that they weren't doing it, and Adlai Stevenson was on the floor defending Kennedy, and the troops were actually in a trying to land there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know why they done that, but I can't believe it was an innocent gesture.
Well, the only thing that I can think is that it was done as, a show of support to a group that they hadn't previously shown support to in any overt way, and it was a slap on the wrist to others, but it was a way to keep people confused enough so that neither side would totally turn against the Carter administration. But I think he's just really screwed up.
Yes.
I don't think it worked. I think he blew it again. In terms of his own motives, I don't think he's even served his own motives well.
I would be the most generous in saying that he didn't know what it was all about. Now, I'm not trying to defend him.
Do you think then that Cy Vance was responsible?
No, I think Zabrinsky was.
So you don't think Carter was?
Yeah. I think that this come after the fact. I'm convinced that poor Carter, I compare him to a bally speecher in a carnival. When there's a crowd getting the midway, you get up and tell them anything to get them in, to buy a ticket and get them in here. Well, poor Carter, sometimes I have to feel sorry for the guy because he gets up and supposedly to know everything, and actually he's a big boob in my book. And he's responsible to the oil interests, and that's all. And he's got a hell of a goddamn road to go.
Well, he seems to be doing an awful lot of on-the-job training. It's kind of disturbing.
Well,
he learns as he, or I don't know if he learns, but he has these experiences which are significant in terms of what he might learn from them, but he just keeps on making huge...
I picked up, and I haven't had a chance to read it yet, in the San Francisco paper a day ago, and I've got it to read yet. I took the paper. It's written by Eugene McCarthy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember him. He's from Minnesota.
Sure, yeah.
And he's writing a series of comments on Carter.
Mm-hmm.
And he calls him Bang, and I just started to read it. And I asked the fellow that had it, I said, you mind if I... I don't know, I think I picked it up in the Examiner, San Francisco Examiner. And I said, mind if I take this paper? He said, no, hell, I've read it. He'd come up from San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't read it yet. And it will probably be reprinted here in one of our papers, but I haven't seen it in the local paper. But he's making some comments on some of these serious mistakes that Carter's made. And if I come across it, I might drop it in the mail to you.
Yeah, sounds interesting.
Well,
I just find it all fascinating that, we're given just enough of a glimpse of the workings of this administration to understand, to know, to sense, to suspect that there's a lot of funny business and a lot of ineptitude and a lot of manipulation going on, and, you know, enough to know that we're getting taken. But, I don't know, I guess...
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and I tell you, Carter is not showman enough to pull it off.
And that, but that, yeah, that's coming through, too. That
that's right.
That he just isn't up to it. He's not going to, he's not going to pull it off.
No.
He may get reelected, though.
Huh?
He may get reelected.
Well, he may. What happened with Kennedy in Massachusetts the other night, you know, the media has been doing a job on Kennedy, and I don't hold him up for anything either. But the media has been doing a terrible job on Kennedy.
Oh, sure.
And, they've been giving him, the worst of everything. And I don't suppose that in a given situation that Kennedy and Carter would react a hell of a lot of difference, except that the Kennedy charisma and force is got something to do with it.
Well, I think the main difference is attributable to the fact that they're running against each other.
That's right.
They're trying to, you know.
And I don't know how far the people are going to go with this charade here. Because everything is pointed out. Now they had, I didn't see it. I was on the road coming into the city the other night when 60 Minutes was on, and I'm not a 60 Minute patriot, but I understand they had a 20 minute section on the CIA and the FBI talking about the various mistakes and things that were done on the Shah of Iran and what's going on over there. And for anyone to stand up and tell me that there was no tortures here, all we have to look at some of these riots in these penitentiaries. Now, I've been in the pen, and I know what it is when people get desperate. And you can't equate that, and you can't pass that on to people unless you've been there. But those situations are terrible to get people to go the way they're going. And this land of free enterprise that we got. Now, what happens in some of those almost barbaric medieval countries? And for me to say that the Shah is a gentleman and he didn't know what was going on, well, that's, you know, that's for the birds.
Well, he's a gentleman if you're in the same league as he is.
Well, yeah, but you ain't going to eat at his same table, you know. He's the king of kings, and he don't come by that rightly either. Well, now, before we get through here, when are we going to talk again?
Well, let's see. Let me take a peek here at my calendar. Let's see. Today is the 5th.
Mm-hmm.
How about the 19th? That's 2 weeks from now.
Oh, very well.
You want to do it then?
That's good.
Okay. Get in, and I'll call you at 11.
Your time.
Yep.
Okay. Now, I have in my notes here that we were going to discuss Fritz Snyder. Is that?
Yeah. Can you say something about him?
Yeah, right now?
No, not now.
Oh, yes. I've made a few little things here.
Oh, good. Okay. We have yet to speak to him. He lives just down the block from me, but we're going to talk with him. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, Fritz is a real old personal friend of mine. Uh-huh. I knew him as a kid in Camden, you know.
Uh-huh.
He was raised in the Camden district in North Minneapolis. We'll talk about that when we get into it.
How are you feeling?
Well, I tell you, I went to Portland, and I went down there to eat at the Oyster Bar with some of my friends.
Mm-hmm.
And we stood around, and I had a top coat in my car, and it was one of those days that you was deceiving. Mm-hmm. And I think I got a cold in my back, and it's just about driving me crazy.
You do sound like you've got a cold, but
yeah.
It lodged in your back? It's
in my lower back. Of course, I injured my back in 1956. I fell 32 feet in a ship, and I was laid up for about 3 years.
32 feet?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And I landed on my heels.
No kidding.
And impacted a couple of vertebrae,
yeah.
And I was off the job. I didn't go back to work until 1958, late in 58.
Oh, my God. That must have been awful.
Oh, it was terrible.
That sounds just dreadful.
And every once in a while, when anything happens, why, it seems to...
You take it in your lower back.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Have you given any more thought to coming out here?
Well, I would like to this summer, but I have some problems here that I have to clean up. And I was thinking of coming back, and maybe if everything is good for me there, I want to spend a couple of weeks with my brother. And I have some friends left in Minneapolis. They're fast disappearing, you know. And I was thinking about maybe buying a new van back there, but that's still in the offing.
I see.
You know, to buy anything new today, you've pretty much got to have a letter of credit with the Bank of England.
Sure.
Because, God almighty, the cost of running things.
Mm-hmm.
So you better make do with what you got.
Well, I'm still hoping I'm going to get out to Seattle.
No, I hope you do, because this is nice country if you haven't been here to remember it.
Well, yeah, I do hope to do
and
that.
And during the summer, it's better, you know. Them dreary, rainy days are not much that you'd want to...
Not after a dreary winter.
No. But it's been a good winter there, hasn't it? It hasn't been too bad.
Well, you know, you're talking to someone who's unhappy if the weather gets below 72.
So. Oh, Honolulu. Hello there.
And it doesn't make any difference to me that I wake up every morning and the Minneapolis sky is blue and
blue. Yeah.
So if it's under 72, you know, I'm not to be consoled. So.
I see. Now, I was thinking, you live on Ridgewood. The place that I was thinking was 510 Groveland.
Yes. Oh, well, that's very close. Washington.
Yeah. That was one of the more elaborate apartment hotels in Minneapolis 40 years ago.
Ah.
The other big one was out at 2615 Park.
I think that the one you're speaking of, the 510 Groveland, has become a residence.
Yeah?
Yeah, because I know someone who lives on Groveland in an apartment, would become an apartment complex.
Well, it was kind of that way. It was an apartment hotel.
Right, and it's very recently become just a residence.
I imagine because it was too much to refurbish it and it couldn't attract the trade. It was the going thing 45 years ago. And there was right next to it, the women's club was in there, I suppose.
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah, we're talking about the same place.
Yeah, I'm quite familiar in there. As a matter of fact, I was a helper on a... And then I used to drive that route. I used to start at Harmon and Hennepin.
Uh-huh.
And take everything west of Hennepin Avenue, everything south of Franklin. I never went beyond Franklin. That was in another route. And then I used to haul that route down there, Yale, Loring and Yale and Spruce,
uh-huh.
Ridgewood, Groveland, and that whole group in there.
Oh, that's my name.
From the Dayton Company to Franklin Street, from Nicollet to Hennepin.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of apartments in there then. I suppose there still is.
Oh, yeah, many.
I know lots of days I used to get two helpers. I had so many packages in them apartment districts.
So there are new apartment buildings.
Oh, yes.
And then some of the formerly single or dual family dwelling units have been broken up into condominiums or apartments.
Well, that's the thing.
Some of the buildings, obviously the older buildings are still there, but the nature of them has changed.
That's right. They've changed them into more revenue producing.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, under capitalism, you know, you got to make a buck or you don't.
Well, and under capitalism, in most neighborhoods, you can't find a parking place here.
That's true.
That's another benefit of it.
Yeah, that's an awful thing. Here, of course, when you build, you have to have 100% off-street parking now.
Oh.
They can't build any place that doesn't have 100% off-street parking.
Well, they damn well better get mass transit soon, then, because no one's going to be able to live in any of those places.
Oh, they can't keep up with the people that are wanting to use the buses here. They can't keep up.
Mm. Same here.
There are buses and buses and buses and just think, if you're not familiar in the Southern California area, think of down there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. Well, Chris,
mm-hmm.
I'll look forward to on the
19th. Yeah, Wednesday. Okay, will you take care of that?
I will.
I'll start feeling better. Okay, we'll talk to you.